The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because
they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon California time space show program. I'm your host, David Livingston, and thank you very much for tuning in. First and foremost, on the part of both myself and the space show and our guest, Dr. Ken Davidian, a great congratulations to SpaceX and to NASA for an outstanding Demo 2 flight that just landed in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of Pensacola. Hopefully many of you got to see it. If not, you can see it on the reruns. But it was, to me, it looked like it was absolutely flawless. Great parachutes, great splashdown. I wish I was on one of those fast boats running out there to go to the capsule. But we certainly congratulate SpaceX and NASA for an incredible job. They said thank you for flying SpaceX, and I guess the United States is back into the human spaceflight transportation business, both to and from space. And that should make everybody really happy, not just SpaceX. So well done, Doug and Bob and SpaceX and Elon and Gwen and all of you. And believe me, we all totally appreciate that. So for our space show today, the toll-free number will be 1-866-687-7223. Do remember there are no call screeners, so you can just be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then you can also post a comment on our blog. And to do that, it's thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the upcoming show menu. And open the first show listed, and that shows Dr. Ken Davidian for today. And when you open that is our blog page. Scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you'll see where you can comment or ask questions. Once again, you do not have to be logged in to discuss to do that. You can do it as a visitor or a guest, which is what I always do, and actually it's what I recommend. It's easier that way, and we'd love to hear from you, but we are a talk show, so we'd actually prefer to hear you talk with us. 1-866-687-7223. A couple of other quick announcements. We're going for the 90-minute format today, but still watch the clock. We want to hear from you, but do so while we're still on the air. And but again, 90 minutes. And then listeners, do remember we're migrating our website to an updated Drupal 8 system. If you have suggestions or recommendations for how we might improve our website, change something, make it work better, fix something, now is the time to speak up while we're in the process of doing this, because we can easily incorporate changes and fixes and clarifications. So email me with your thoughts and suggestions at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our newsletter got updated today. So if you look at our website newsletter over on the upper right of our homepage, you will see us going into next week. Be sure to scroll down on that website newsletter, and you will see what we have planned through maybe the first few days of October. And by the next time we do this, we will have opened up dates for the balance of the year. That sounds really weird to me, that here we are in August, and I'm starting to open up my schedule for the rest of 2020. It has definitely been a weird year, to say the least. Remember, all of our programs are archived, so you can download shows quickly or listen off of our website. For those of you interested in Space Show t-shirts, coffee mugs, things of that nature, click on any of the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and she will escort you to our Cafe Press logo-ware store, where hopefully you will find what you're looking for. And we appreciate that. Upper left has a listen live menu. This is important. Please share the information. It tells you how to listen to a live program like what we're doing right now. Archives on our website, which are compressed MP3s, and then podcasts. We're available in lots and lots of the podcasting platforms for both Android and Apple. A few of them we're still trying to get listed in, but if you have a recommendation, please email it to me. If you are having a podcast or archive listening issue, I'm happy to try to troubleshoot with you. Email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Then remember, always for me, the most important part is that we're a nonprofit, listener-supported 501c3 radio program. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And by being listener-funded, you, the listener, through your generous support, helps us keep the program going and have great guests and covering a great topic with an incredible paper that he wrote, which we'll talk about in a minute. Today, none of this comes growing on trees or comes free of charge. We appreciate those of you who do help us and support us, especially in these troubling economic times, for sure. They're troubling for us as well. And your support is what keeps us on the air. So there is a big PayPal button at the top of each of our website pages. That's the easiest way to support us. And again, people just like you are keeping us on the air and supporting us, and we deeply appreciate that. If you don't want to use PayPal, you can do checks. They're made payable to One Giant Leap Foundation. They're mailed to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And then more about sponsorships during our break when we go from first segment to second segment. But remember, we do have sponsorships available. The sponsors get banner ads running across the homepage. They can change those banner ads and certainly change what they link to underneath as often as they want. And on the longer formatted program, I read a sponsor message, which I will do when we break from first to second segment. Our great sponsors are Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. More about that later, but if you're interested in sponsorship opportunities, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So we have a returning guest today. Many of you know from the Space Show, but also many of you probably know in person or from multiple over the years space conferences and space appearances. His full bio is on the website, so you can read about him. But Dr. Ken Davidian is back with us. He is a director of research at the AST with the FAA, but he's also editor-in-chief of the New Space Journal publication, which is an excellent journal. You will hear more about that in a few minutes as well, too. Ken, in June of this year, wrote a space tourism article. It's not your everyday space tourism article about how cool this is going to be or that or this or that. It is really an amazing, high-quality analysis. It's titled Space Tourism Industry Emergence, Description and Data. And on the blog for this show, I have posted a link for you to go read or download the PDF for this paper. Again, it was published June 12th of this year. If you're interested in space tourism, and I sure hope you are, you need to read and have a printed copy available of Ken's paper. Ken, we're really happy to talk to you again. And how are you today? And it's a great day with that splashdown. I wish I was there in the Gulf of Mexico, too. But we're glad to have you. How are you doing?
Hi, David. Yeah, I'm doing really well. I'm glad to hear that things are going well for you there in California. And hopefully everybody's staying safe and staying healthy and socially distant and being responsible. And, yeah, it's a beautiful day here. I guess the storm is coming in the next couple days. But everybody's pretty much staying home here and trying to be productive.
Well, I notice you and I are socially distanced today by about 3,000 miles, so so we're doing our part, right?
That's right.
Let's see. I want you to talk about the New Space Journal, but start out and tell us about this. Is a special kind of space tourism paper. When you sent it and said space tourism paper, I thought I was going to read another space tourism paper about opportunities and suborbital and this and that and the other. You didn't do that. Introduce us to this paper. It's informative. It's educational. It's an incredibly important read.
No, thank you very much for that. I want to do important work. This grew out of my PhD work, my dissertation, and about at the end of 2014, I decided I wanted to get a PhD. And, you know, that all came out of the need from, you know, I love my job, basically. Let me start with that. And my primary job is, like you said, I'm the director of research at the FAA Office of Commercial Space Transportation in Washington, D.C. And in my job, I pretty much am, you know, we have two main missions at our office. One is to ensure the safety of the uninvolved public during space launches and reentries that are undertaken by and for entities other than the U.S. government, so commercial space launches and reentries. We make sure we protect the public. But we have a second mission, which is to encourage, facilitate, and promote, you know, a safe and successful commercial space transportation industry. And my job has always been toward that second goal. I've had very little, if any, responsibility on the safety side of our office, but I've always had responsibility on the encourage, facilitate, and promote side of the mission that our office has. So that led to my director of research, you know, me leading the Center of Excellence for Commercial Space Transportation, which is 10 universities now doing research to help encourage the industry. And about 6 years ago in 2014, I said, you know, I'm seeing a lot of people with a lot of practical experience doing these things, giving advice to my bosses, but there's nobody that has an academic background in industry emergence or, you know, in how to grow an industry, what's the appropriate role of government in the industry. And really, there's only one other person in our industry that had this kind of knowledge, and that's Dr. Greg Autry, who had just in 2014 gotten his PhD from UC Irvine. And so I had been talking to Greg, and I had done a bunch of reading since 2007, mostly on strategy, but started getting into some work theory stuff. And Greg encouraged me to get a PhD, so I decided to sign up for a PhD. I wanted to get a PhD, but without having to quit my job. And so I found a program that was research only. You didn't have to do the 2 years of coursework that would be required by most North American and Western European kind of universities. So I was able to find a program at the University of Cape Town, Graduate School of Business. So basically I would go to Cape Town 4 or 5 times a year to participate in workshops, and I worked on my PhD through that program. The upside, obviously, was I didn't need to take 2 years of classes, and that's 2 years full-time. It would have been 4 to 5 years part-time, and that would have driven me nuts, because then you'd need to do the 2 to 3 to 4 years of dissertation work. So I decided to, the good side was that I knew I could accomplish the dissertation part, but the downside was I didn't have those courses. So it put an extra burden on me for the reading. And so, you know, I've made a real emphasis on doing a lot of reading. Getting that PhD was a process of trying to help, you know, bolster, at least from an academic perspective, you know, our encourage, facilitate, and promote mission for Office of Commercial Space Transportation. And so, again, the research question or the academic domain was org theory and industry emergence, and the industry context that I chose was human suborbital spaceflight. And so you see the result of it here. The result of is this paper that doesn't talk about the theoretical contribution for which I got the PhD, because that goes into org theory. And to be honest with you, most space people and most people that aren't into org theory don't really care about the org theory, right?
Right.
what this paper is basically telling the story, you know, taking the data that I collected, and we could talk about the type of data I collected, but it's taking that data and putting it in a framework and telling the story within that framework. So the framework I chose was a particular model of the innovation process and the industry change or the industry innovation process, so in this case, industry emergence. And the data I used was from the human suborbital spaceflight population. And so the result is this paper here. And as I say in the beginning of the paper, the report has two goals. The first is to tell the story within this framework. The second goal is to give the data away, to allow others to use this data. The way that I collected the data and the type of data I collected was very particular. It was this methodology was started or was pioneered back in the mid-80s, and it was designed so that different folks, if they used the same data collection process, could pool the data to help support each other's propositions and theoretical contributions. And so that's what this is. And so that's why by giving this data away, if we get other studies done in the same methodology, then that data can all be pooled to support each other's research questions. And in fact, it can support other new research questions that might come out from future research. So it's data which is not unique to this one research question. So, and I can talk about later some of the efforts we're doing within Center of Excellence for commercial space transportation, where we're doing exactly that. We're studying other industry segments using this exact same data collection methodology with the idea that they could all be pooled.
Okay, so what does that mean for the overall space tourism industry? You're describing it, and you have lots of data. I've read your conclusion, so I know your conclusion, but where does that lead us? What does that do for the reader?
Well, so there's different conclusions or there are different implications for different types of users, right? So for an entrepreneur or for people that are in the practitioner side of the activities, they can look at the data, they can read this story, and they can see what parts of the market have a lot of activity. They have very well developed, you know, let's say what we call infrastructure, whether it's intellectual property or whether it's laws and regulations, whether it's financial arrangements. You know, they can look at that and see where a lot of the industry infrastructure. And when we say industry infrastructure, it's not like spaceports. It's all these different elements of what it takes to grow an industry. Of all those elements, you can look at the data and see which ones are very well developed and which ones are not very well developed. And this could be used by practitioners, you know, the firm owners and the large companies to decide where they want to compete and where they want to cooperate. For example, in the data right now, I do not have a lot of examples of different types of industry standards. You know, standards come in three different flavors. There's ad hoc or de facto standards. That's where if one company goes ahead and starts doing it and everybody starts copying it, it becomes a de facto standard. There are industry consensus standards where the industry gets together and voluntarily agrees to do something and it becomes a standard that way. Then there's government mandated standards, and that which could be mandated either through regulation or through contractual terms or something like that. And so right now when I look at my chart, and I've got a chart in the report, this is the color chart that's super, super detailed and super complex. In that chart, along the standards column, there's almost nothing there. And so this is one of the areas where there could be more work done. And, in fact, there is more work being done to develop standards. But it's very, very it's very hard. It's a negotiated process. It becomes politically charged very quickly. And, frankly, especially in this population of right now two active firms, Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin, you know, they need to have an incentive to work together, and sometimes that's hard to find. So the implications for the entrepreneur and the businesses are that they might see where to compete and cooperate, and see where they stand with respect to how all the different elements of the industry are maturing. For policymakers and for regulators and stuff, we could look at this and kind of understand what's happening, you know, how we fit into the big picture of interactions. I mean, the whole point of, and this gets into a whole discussion about looking at a market as a financial system or a system of finances and technologies, which is typically the way an economist would look at it, versus the way a business person or a business academic looks at it as a social system. So you're going to include all these institutional, whether it's governmental or political activity type of activities that are conducted by companies. You look at it as a social system. So it gets a lot more complex, a lot quicker. Like I said, there are ways to model different industries, and technologists will look at it by what technologies are required, and they'll do a microscopic look at all the different technologies. Economists will look at it from a perspective of the financial arrangements, as well as the technologies, how they interact, intellectual property and things like that. But then once you do look at it from the business perspective, and again, this is from an academic business perspective, it becomes part of a larger social system. And even then, we add, institutional arrangements like legitimization and governance and standards to the resource endowments, which is the financial and the human competence and the science and technology. And the third area is proprietary functions. So once you look at it from that big perspective, things start getting very complicated because there's a lot going on within each of those three areas as well as between the three areas. And this is all to say that this is one step away from what we sort of know is reality, which is there's actually a fourth element, which is culture, right, and society. And we just don't know how to model that very well. And so that, from a business administration perspective, we sort of like assume that part of a way. We say, well, we're not going to deal with that right now. So that's one of the major differences between looking at markets from an economic perspective, which is what you hear mostly, when you hear about venture capital, when you hear about accelerators and stuff. A lot of times they're looking at it primarily, or they'll talk about it in terms primarily from an economic perspective, whereas from a business perspective, it takes more of a social science, turn, and it starts bringing in more of the fuzziness, things that are harder to quantify. So you have to embrace the qualitative data that you can collect.
When I did my PhD dissertation, a lot of it was dedicated to space tourism. So that was mid-90s, and I finished it in 2001 or sometime around there. And when I look at the industry, I mean, some of the mechanisms for space tourism have really changed. Like, they were touting single-stage orbit vehicles, and all of that was gone.
Right.
They don't exist, and a lot of those companies don't exist. So a lot of the mechanisms or the methods for accomplishing space tourism have come and gone. The industry still doesn't really exist other than, the promises of those two companies and their testing and their planning and their developing, plus people flying to the International Space Station, which is space tourism in a way. But, I mean, this is an industry that's more than 20, 25 years in the making without any reality to it.
Right. Well, so, yeah, that's absolutely right.
Help me.
What I was going to say was that, so the data that I collected was basically events. When you look through all the blogs and all the posts and read all the reports, you have a lot of things that in this methodology you call incidents.
Right.
There'll be an announcement, that so-and-so, sold so many tickets, or, they'll have all these announcements.
Right.
And there might actually, or we're going to have a flight test next week. And then, the flight test is tomorrow. And then they have the flight test. And then there's a report afterwards saying there was a flight test yesterday and this is what we found out. And then maybe there's another report, like a profile of the pilot. So each of those things could be an incident, but one of those things, the flight itself, that was the event. So what we do is we collect all these incidents, and in my paper, I think we on the order of 8,500 incidents. That's the number of records that I had in my original database. And from that 8,500 incidents, we boiled it down to about 400 or so events. And those 400 events are what we plot out on our timeline. Versus, which industry infrastructure element you know, these events were helping to construct. And then from that timeline, you can start looking at it. And in the paper, I even talk about how you can show that there's a statistically significant increase in the number of events, you know, after the XPRIZE competition. Now, the XPRIZE was not one event. Obviously, it was announced in 96, and it was won in 2004. So between, you know, pre-96 and post-94, or 2004, there's a major change in the number of events that took place there. So now you talk about your PhD. You got it in 2001. That was right in the middle of the, I'm sorry, XPRIZE. So the things were still heating up. But despite the fact that we've gotten a lot of major events that have happened since then, like you said, everybody is still in what's called pre-production. Nobody has delivered, right?
Uh-huh.
Nobody's delivered the service for compensation. So people have reserved tickets, but nobody's flown. And so right now, within this market, within this industry segment, nobody, you know, we're in pre-production still. So, yeah, you're right. Nobody's entered the market, really.
Well, we haven't even gotten to post-production yet, which would be we're ready to go and launch the film, right?
Well, actually, production would just be good. Just get it into production.
So why is,
prior to that.
From your opinion, why is that? Is it because it's a lot harder than people thought to do this? Is it because they needed a boatload more of money than they thought they maybe needed? I think the people are ready for it. Whatever customers there are out there for it, they're ready for it. Why hasn't it happened? Why is it a rhetoric-rich industry?
Well, I think rhetoric richness is a part of any new entrepreneurial and industry startup. That's part of the job of the entrepreneurs and stuff. You know, being able to sell it and become cheerleaders for their activity because they're trying to legitimize the activity and they're trying to make it appear, you know, like taken for granted in society, something that's totally new like this. So I think cheering it on and talking it up is sort of normal. I think that one of the major mistakes we make is that when we say, oh, when we think in terms of years, it's going to be so many years from now. In reality, especially with things that require hardware and manufacturing and complex systems like this, instead of thinking in years, we need to think in decades, right? So, you know, my data goes back to, you know, the first data I look at is the early tests of the X vehicles that started in the mid-1950s. And so going from mid-1950 to 2015, that's 60, 70 years right there, right?
Right.
So we're in a period of seven decades of growth. Post XPRIZE, we're two decades in. And so instead of, you know, absolutely in 2004, everybody was saying 2 to 3 years, right?
And right.
Maybe 2 to 3 decades. So I think it's just, everybody's, especially the fanboys, especially, you know, the people that really want this to happen, and myself included, you really want it to happen, quicker, but I think it's, you know, looking at the data as I've been doing for the last number of years, you know, it just seems like it just takes decades instead of years. Another observation, which I, you know, would be a proposition that I would put forward, just based on what I've seen in this data, and you're starting to see it in some other industry segments, is that instead of the companies that are working on budgets of tens of millions of dollars don't tend to be able to make it. In the long run, it's the companies that work with hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's not a true statement for every single non-governmental space segment. But for this one, that's what it seems. I mean, you look at Virgin, you look at Blue, you know, you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in those types of chunks. I mean, the $20 million that Boeing put into Virgin is really kind of token. It's the hundreds of millions that really matter. And so that's another just reality that we need to come to grips with. I mean, for industries that are high technology, high capital cost, and where their customers' lives are put in danger through in the use, which this industry or this market would definitely fill into that category, you really have to have a high degree of faith in the product. That means legitimacy has to be very high. Safety has to be high. And to attain that level of safety, reliability, legitimacy, it just takes a lot of work. And so I think, you know, they can't roll out a beta version that is going to break and then make subsequent fixes. They have to get it right the first time. So whether or not the interior should be gray instead of white, or whether the armrest should be 13 inches apart instead of, you know, 12 inches apart, that's inconsequential. You just want to make sure that people go up, enjoy themselves, and come back down. So it just takes a while to get that right, I guess.
You got a caller on hold, so let's see if they're still with us. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you? Where are you?
Hi, this is John of Fremont, California.
Hi, John. Did you get to watch SpaceX come down?
I did.
Cool, right?
It was really cool.
Go ahead.
Well done.
Yep.
Yeah. So, Kent, I enjoyed your article and or your paper. Sorry. But I'm curious. You said the model was developed back in the 80s. Did that model? Where did the model come from? And did it have any parallels to the aviation industry?
Okay, great question, John. So what I was referring to was the methodology of data collection was pioneered in the 80s. This is the specific definition of the term innovation process. So the guy that did this was at Minnesota University, or University of Minnesota, I guess, in the mid-80s. His name is Andy Van de Ven, very, very well known in the management community. He did something called the Minnesota Innovation Research Program, MIRP, and was funded primarily, if I'm not mistaken, by the Office of Naval Research. And what they did was they did 14 research projects. They had 14 individual research projects looking at industry innovation. And so innovation is about change. And when you're talking about org theory, they're talking about organizations. And when we say organizations, there are different levels of organizations. The market level organizations are everything above the firm. So below, from the firm down, you've got firms, you've got subunits, like divisions and directorates and branches, and then you've got teams and then individuals. And so those are the levels that are at the firm level or inter-firm level. The market level of analysis in org theory are where you've got groups of firms, and which we might call an industry segment, or what the social scientists call populations. And then you could even have groups of populations, which are called communities or industries. So, for example, propulsion might be an industry, and an industry segment might be liquid rocket engines or solid rocket motors. So we're looking at the industry segment level and above. And what he did was what they did in the Minnesota program, where they had 14 different programs, and they were looking at all different levels of analysis. Some of them were looking at industry. Some of them were looking at individual products within a company. And so they all followed the same data collection process. And by doing that, they were able to use each other's data to help support whatever propositions or theory they were developing. The way that innovation or change happens within an organization or within a population or community, the way industries evolve or change, is not very well understood. And so there's a lot of theory development that's going on, and collecting data this way is really, really, really allows you to use other people's data for different types of research questions other than the one you happen to be, researching at the time. So it's all based on the definition of the innovation process. And the way Van de Ven defines it is, and it's in the paper, motivating and coordinating people, which is the people are the first concept, to develop and implement new ideas. Ideas are the second concept, by engaging in transactions or relationships, that's the third, with others in making the adaptations needed to achieve desired outcomes, which is the fourth concept, within changing institutional and organizational contexts. So those are the five main concepts that you have to follow through and find events within the industry you're studying, you know, that change any one of those five concepts. And that's what we did here. What Van de Ven did at that time was he studied the cochlear implant industry. And he came up with this laundry list of what does an industry need to grow, and these are the industry infrastructure elements that that we used. And in my research, I took them and I modified them a little bit. But at the first level and second level, pretty much they stayed the same. I was tweaking at the third level down. And so that model or that methodology system was what I was talking about was developed in the 1980s. The innovation process model, which is called the fireworks model, that is the framework that we tell this story in, that sort of came out of the Minnesota Innovation Research Project work. And in a book that he wrote, I want to say in late 1990s, early 2000, called The Innovation Journey, this is where he shows this innovation model, which has got those 12 steps to it, right? And three phases and 12 different steps. And that came out of the work of the Minnesota Innovation Research Project. So your question then about is this applicable to aviation? Yes, you could look at the aviation industry and try to tell it in the same story. There's a lot of parallels to the aviation industry of what we see right now, but I think it's not as close as we think. You know, the aviation industry, you know, when it was very early on, Wright Brothers and Curtis, you know, they were fighting each other. Wright Brothers had the patents and they wouldn't, release them. And so then the Manufacturer Aircraft Association was created, led by FDR, where the government convened both Curtis and Wright Brothers together and said, "You're going to use your patents. We're going to combine them. You'll each get a cut of royalties, but the U.S. military needs your planes, and so we're going to start building these things, combining the IP." And so the government was able to convene this consortium, start banging out planes, and then, of course, you had the Kelly Mail Act and all this sort of stuff. But during that entire time, air travel was totally controlled by the government, right? The routes that airlines could fly, the prices they could charge were totally controlled. So in that sense, it was sort of like a consortium, or it was sort of like where, you know, they're going to control the prices. The prices were controlled, so the airlines had to compete on quality and technical performance, which they did. So I don't know if that's the same. I don't know if the analogy is going to hold as well, and I haven't done a real in-depth study of that. There's a lot of really good books out there that some of them I've read and they're on my shelf. Some of them I haven't read and they're on my shelf, and I'm sure there's a bunch of others. But I don't know how well the aviation industry is going to hold up in terms of the same level of government control of the industry as it is for certain industry segments of commercial space. But, you know, it's obviously worth taking a look. And I'm sorry for running on like this, but one of the things that this highlights is a trap that I fall into often, is that we tend to overgeneralize. Commercial space, especially in the transportation, is not one thing. I can think of 8 or 9 segments of commercial space transportation, and each of those segments, basically industry segments, have their own problems. They're at different levels of maturity, and so they're going to display different characteristics. So we kind of, and same thing with aviation, you know, cargo, general aviation, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we need to start getting more specific when we start doing comparisons. We need to compare or find analogies between similar industry segments. We can't compare an entire sector. You know, I don't even know what commercial space transportation is. It might be an industry. So, you know, it's hard to compare an entire sector to another entire sector because there's so much variation within the sector.
So, yes, it does. Thank you. You looked at mainly the suborbital market, right? So I'm wondering, we haven't seen anything there, but can there be look, I want to go to space. I can't afford it
Me
now.
Too.
I don't want to go up for like 30 seconds. I want to go, and I want to go to a destination, a hotel in orbit or something like that. And can we use some of the data for the suborbitals and apply it to the orbital market? You know what I mean?
So yes and no. I mean, again, and we haven't talked at all about the org theory. So this gets into the question between academic and practitioner and stuff. And so when you start talking about org theory, the academic part of it, there's a lot of things you can talk about that, again, the space community almost really doesn't care about, but the academics in org theory will care about it. It's those things that we'll be able to carry over to the orbital. So if we could sit and understand, like, like particular or peculiar characteristics of industry emergence that we might see in suborbital spaceflight, you know, that might be applicable to orbital spaceflight based on the concept that somehow or other space industries or space industry segments are unique or not the same in some ways as any other industry segment. From a researcher perspective, I want them to be the same because I want my theory to be applicable to many industry segments. You know, but a lot of people that I talk to still have the gut feeling, if nothing else, that somehow or other space is different. So if it is indeed different, it's understanding those differences that could be applicable to orbital. There are different ways of doing research, right? And basically, when you start doing research on a phenomenon that's not very well known, you start saying, what is it? What's going on? You know, that's the first question. The second one is, why is it going on? What things are happening, you know, at one point in the phenomenon that might cause other things to happen in the phenomenon? In trying to figure out what's going on or why is it going on, that's when you start identifying independent variables. What is the X that leads to the Y, and what could be the function of X that gives you some idea of what Y is? So that's where you move from the realm of process research, which is what I did, into variance research, trying to understand what is the X and what is the Y? What are the independent variables and dependent variables of the phenomena we're understanding? And then the third question is, so what does that mean? What are the implications? And this is where all my bosses lie. They say, well, do we have too many spaceports? Are there too many companies? They start asking these specific questions, which really rely on the assumption that you've got a function that you understand, and now how do I optimize that function somehow, or how do I find the maximum or the minimum of that function? And so really they want to jump to that third set of questions without ever having asked the first two questions. And so a lot of the data that you see that companies will come out with, they sort of will make assumptions. They'll skip over the first set of questions, the process research questions, and they'll jump right to the second set of questions. They'll say, oh, the independent variables are this, this, and this. And they're assuming that. They don't know that for sure. You know, but it makes sense, and nobody really argues with them. And then they say here, you know, they'll draw it up, and they'll try to, you know, put it on a log chart, and they'll draw a line, and they'll say this is the function. And it's a nice straight line, and so people kind of buy it. But really, nobody's really done the process research that helps build the confidence that we've identified what the phenomenon is and what the independent variables and dependent variables might be. And so that's what this research is. This research is answering that first question of what's happening. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to make this data totally public was that so my bosses at the Office of Commercial Space Transportation, they'll know exactly who got what licenses on what date. They'll know who funded who. Who knows when these kind of questions are going to come up? Because we get questions, you know, from Congress all the time, or we get them from the White House, and we don't know what questions they're going to ask. And so this is sort of like an encyclopedia of what happened. And you kind of need to know that if you want to sort of understand the process. And if the process is unique to space industry, or it's something that could be shared with orbital tourism, this is the only way you're going to know it. So what we need to do, John, is to go out and do process research for the orbital transportation industry and see where there are similarities. Currently in the Center of Excellence, we're doing process research not for orbital tourism. We're doing it for small sat launchers, and we're doing it for spaceport emergence. So, you know, we had to pick which ones we could do. We can't do them all at the same time. One of the reasons I picked human suborbital was, you know, my original idea was to do everything, but the first thing you learn in, you know, doctorate in school is, boom, you got to de-scope, narrow it down as much as possible. So I focus just on human suborbital. But we'd love to be able to do human orbital and do a similar kind of research to help understand the phenomenon of what's happening. And then we can start figuring out what are the independent variables and dependent variables and see if there's any similarities then between the suborbital and the orbital industries. So, I mean, it's research. This is absolutely research. It's social science research, really. And it we need to start doing it because it takes time. I don't know if that helps your answer. That answers your question, John.
Yeah,
I'm with you.
No,
I'm going to go too.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Great topic. And I'll get off the air and let someone else call in.
Thank you, John.
Thanks a lot, John. And David, what I was going to mention also was that, you know, there's this underlying thing here of academic versus practitioner. I mean, right now our industries have got a lot of great people doing a lot of great work, and I think my the events that I've shown, you know, kind of bear that out. We've got people that, you know what they're doing, and they're doing some great work. But, you know, I've been told in the past, you know, oh, we don't need to study this stuff. We just, you got to go out and do it. And that's absolutely true, kind of. You know, I think there is a need to understand this from the academic perspective and from the generic, you know, org theory perspective, so that space is just the context. You know, the org theory, the academic side is kind of detached from the space, you know, enthusiasm. So this is kind of what we're trying to do here, is trying to bring the academic community into the discussion, because it really hasn't been there before, and trying to get the input from the practitioner community and make sure that that helps inform the research that we're doing.
First of all, listeners, the line is available since John is finished with it, and so if you want to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223. Partially tongue-in-cheek, but also partially valid and real, given my nearly 20 years of doing this, there is a third group that might somehow be worked into consideration with academic and practitioner, and that is, as you referred to it yourself a little while ago, the fanboy group. So don't laugh at that, but the fanboys make assumptions that aren't based on anything, but they are wedded to those assumptions because, God forbid, anybody's going to come rain on their parade for whatever they're assuming about and whatever they want. So they write articles. They come on my show. They go elsewhere. They give presentations at conferences, not usually a peer-reviewed conference, but an advocacy conference. And you've heard them as much as I do. And they will give conclusions and results based on totally ludicrous assumption making because they don't have any ability to work with a real assumption or come up with a real assumption or do the due diligence to get an assumption. But I think they impact the growth of the industry or the progress of the industry. So
I do, and you know, I don't mean to demean. I'm an enthusiast, a fan, as much as anybody else. However, and I think the work that fans do and the social awareness is really super important. I think doing research is why you go to get a PhD, is to learn how to do research, right?
Correct.
And so that's why, you know, I think doing research that's really based in traditional academic methodologies is super important because we don't have a lot of that. I think that the legitimacy of the industry, and legitimacy is a major concept in the business administration kind of academic world. And again, my PhD is not in economics, it's in business. And when you look at the social systems aspect of things, legitimacy and survival are really what drive actions of individuals and firms. It's not profit and self-interest. You know, that's the economic perspective. From the business perspective, it's legitimacy and survival. And I was just watching Ford versus Ferrari the other day. And, you know, Henry Ford II is making these totally financially irrational decisions, right, to start a racing company and pour millions of $1960, $9 million in 1960, when the average salary of a NASA engineer was $6,000, right? This is not a financially rational decision, but it's about legitimacy. They wanted the brand of Ford to be equated with winning and victory. And so this is what a social scientist thinks drives, you know, motivation. And so trying to, you know, this is part of the reason we want to do research, but the legitimacy also comes from the taken for grantedness. And this is where the enthusiasts come in, and doing those conferences and making people aware and talking in a language that other people can understand. I mean, you know, I've learned about myself, you know, I'm called the maximizer at work, because things, when I draw up a diagram, it's super complex, you know, and the idea there is that you can't get to simplicity without understanding the complexity first, because by looking at the complexity, you can identify the part of the puzzle that is the most important part, and then you can simplify down to that. If you try to get to the final right answer by simplifying, you know, starting off simple without understanding the complexity, chances are not real good you're going to get to the final answer or correct answer in a simplistic way. So my problem is I tend to talk with more academic terms, and I tend to focus on the complexity, you know, and I would say that I probably need to simplify things more. You'd probably agree.
To me, simplicity is rooted in complexity. So
yeah.
When you look at the simple, graceful, gorgeous lines in a sculpture or a piece of architecture, a building maybe, or a house or art, it is actually very complex to do simple. So I'm 100% with you. You don't just slap something together that's easy, that doesn't take any time, and it's not rooted in any in any principles or anything. That's not simple.
Right. Well, like I said, I would definitely support, you know, the activity of the enthusiasts and the fan base, because these are the folks that are going to get the message in a simplified way to other people that would understand it.
True. So I used to be much more condemning of that group, but I do certainly understand their role. But I wish they had more grounded assumption-making capabilities. I guess that's the way I would say it. Because what a lot of it is proposed is nonsensical, I think that it would be great if they put a minimum of effort out to do some legitimate assumption-making and examining, and they could still have their dreams, because. I'm sure Musk had dreams, but he also rooted it in, you know, real physics and real engineering. He didn't just make assumptions and throw numbers up in the air and say that's going to do it. Maybe he did that at first. I don't know. To go to human spaceflight, to get that off the ground, are we looking at a similar kind of decades time period, or can it sort of ride on the shoulders of what's being done in the experience of suborbital, so that some of the development time to reality will be shorter?
Pulling stuff out of my back pocket here. What I would say is that I would say almost that the human orbital is probably ahead of the game than the human suborbital, just because it's got the history and such the vast experience of all the stuff that NASA has done and all the other countries, well, Russia, I guess, and now China, in terms of human orbital work. I mean, all that scientific knowledge, technological knowledge, operational knowledge that was developed by the governments is part of the gestation period, right, of the new industry. And when you look at the fireworks model of innovation, and yeah, I appreciate, Dave, number one, I'll mention again, just to plug it, you provide the listeners in the comments section of today's show's page, you provide a link to the...
to the paper, yeah.
To the paper, so that people can get it. I really, really appreciate that. I put that link up on LinkedIn a couple weeks ago, and right now it's got over 8,000 views, and I don't know how many downloads that's going to talk to Marianne Liebert. But in the paper, it shows the model, right?
And right.
When it talks about the new industries that are starting up, there's always this gestation period. And there was a long gestation period. This is when the government is doing the research before any firm has entered the market and any firm has even thought about it. There was this long gestation period. And so now you have Elon Musk, that started up in 2001, saying, I want to take people to Mars or now to the moon or wherever. You know, he's building on this long, rich history of gestation period. One of the interesting things of about suborbital is that, you know, NASA and Air Force, and anybody that's doing orbital doesn't really care about suborbital, right?
Right.
So all the medical, all the physiological research that was done through the Center of Excellence for Commercial Space Transportation, taking people, average people from, I don't know, 18 to 80 in age, and spinning them in a centrifuge up at Southampton, Pennsylvania at the NASTAR centrifuge, doing that, we were spinning people in suborbital acceleration profiles, which NASA has no interest in that. I mean, they don't do that. And then, by the way, we are doing people that are very young to very old, and NASA and Air Force would never do that. And, oh, yeah, by the way, we're spinning people that have heart disease, back and neck injuries, implanted device, asthma, diabetes, all these different common disease states. Why? Because these are going to be the customers, you know, people who are a little bit overweight or a lot of bit of overweight. NASA and the Air Force would never do this. And so we're doing things that, and we've done things that are unique to human suborbital. So in that sense, and that's kind of why I'm, you know, basically making the statement that I think orbital is actually farther along than human suborbital. There's so much we don't know about human suborbital, whereas with orbital, we've really done this quite a bit, so we know quite a bit more.
Well, and now you see SpaceX doing it for real with a client. So that's ahead of the guys who want to do suborbital flight.
That's right. And so, but, you know, obviously people were flying, you know, there's a lot of suborbital flights based on today's regulatory definition. There was a lot of suborbital flights with the X-15 and all these other X-planes, but they didn't really go very high necessarily. X-15 did, went over a couple hundred kilometers one or two times. The two Mercury flights that were suborbital obviously went above 100 kilometers, went to about 200, between 175 and 200. But other than that, NASA hasn't really done much suborbital. So, you know, we're definitely, you know, suborbital is going to be where a lot more people get to fly. Like John said, you know, I want to go, and even though I want to go to a destination and stuff, I'm not going to have $50 million to do that. You know, I might be able to mortgage my house to the hilt and get two tickets for $250K so that me and my wife can go on a suborbital flight. But, yeah, it's just going to take a while. I mean, we thought that Virgin and Blue would be flying this year, and then bam, COVID, right?
Well, they could get away from COVID if they blew. You think about it that way. So
for 15 minutes. Yeah.
Do you want to go on a suborbital flight, or are you sort of waiting in the background for orbital possibilities?
Oh no, I would definitely do suborbital, and my selection of industry context is not totally unbiased. Right? What I found, and I don't know if this is universal or not, and it's interesting because getting a social science, a business PhD, I'm sure is so much different than an engineering PhD. I'm an aerospace engineer. You know, I got my bachelor's and my master's in aerospace and mechanical engineering. My career started as liquid rocket engine analysis and performance prediction at NASA Lewis. Now NASA Glenn. So I'm a liquid rocket engine guy. But when you go into a PhD program in the business school, it's funny, everybody on day one stands up and says, "Hi, my name's Ken, I work here, and I'm going to study the human suborbital space industry." And in fact, my thesis title was some intelligible set of words, but I had to change it to space tourism industry for the paper just because it would be a lot more understandable. And again, I'm the maximizer in here. I need to just simplify it. But so I get up and I say, I'm going to do, you know, human space flight, suborbital space flight. And the person next to me, you know, they were talking about, you know, the mining industry or something because that's where they came from. And it turns out that when you get your PhD, nobody cares about the context. Your context could be anything. What's the academic contribution you're going to make? What's the, you know, what theory are you going to be contesting or trying to develop? You know, so it's, to me, I chose human suborbital because I am just totally into it. I mean, I used Fusion 360 to sculpt a model of the Spaceship Two, so I could print it out on my 3D printers because, you know, a 3D model is not available online. You know, Blue Origin, same thing. I modeled that using Tinkercad so I could print it out. So if we ever do a Zoom call, you'll see all my space models, my spaceship models hanging on the wall behind me. So I'm just totally into it. I would do suborbital in a minute.
We're a little more than halfway through the show, so I need to pause for about 2 minutes, everybody, to provide our sponsor messages because they do keep the space show on the air. I'll keep the line available, but if you want to step away, it's about a 2-minute vacation from airtime. Okay, Ken?
Okay.
So, listeners, we do have sponsorships, and you can find out more if you email me, or I guess you could call me, those of you that have my number, or find it on the website. But you can email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So the sponsors do get the banner message, and they rotate across our homepage. You can change it as often as you want. And I read the messages on the longer formatted programs. So, for example, Northrop Grumman sponsors us, and they're a leading global security company with innovative systems, products, and solutions for government and commercial customers globally. And they have capabilities undersea to outer space, and also they're involved heavily in cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us, and as I say, if you have never been to a Space Foundation symposium, you're really missing something. You need to do at least one in your life. Unfortunately, it didn't happen this year because of the virus, but go to spacesymposium.org for all the details on what they're doing to catch up on the 36th symposium, and then go to the 37th. They're always in Colorado Springs and at the Broadmoor Hotel, and it's networking at an incredibly high level. I doubt that you could see 100% of the exhibition hall during the several days of the conference. It's so extensive, and you'll want to talk to so many different people. So check it all out. Get the latest on their plans. SpaceSymposium.org. Astrox sponsors us, and they've been involved in hypersonic space plane work, along with reusable rocket designs for DARPA, NASA, and the Air Force for more than 30 years. You can get a lot more information at their website, which is astrox.com. They are inside the Beltway in the Washington, D.C. area. And Dr. A.J. Kothari is their principal. So do check them out. He, by the way, has great return to the moon plans. And I keep saying we need to get him back on the air to talk about that. So I'm making a note to contact A.J. AIAA sponsors us, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have all of their events now are virtual, obviously because of COVID-19, but typically they have five big major events a year, and then regionally they have regional sectors, and they have sometimes breakfast meetings, lunch meetings, dinner presentations. It's a great organization, and you don't have to be an engineer to be a member, and membership fees are low, especially if you're not an engineer or if you're retired. So check it out. Get all the information at AIAA.org. They also have terrific networking, and they have a peer-reviewed library going back decades, which you can access. And I used it extensively for my PhD work. Moonward sponsors us. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based their decisions on technical and economic merit? Moonwards is building a digital visual vision of that town, where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwards.com. You can access an early draft of the town. You can help fund by subscribing Moonwards and help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Celestis sponsors us, and they are still the company to go to for memorial space-based space flights. So if you want to memorialize or honor a loved one, you can put ashes or DNA on a Celestis flight. You can even mix a little of your DNA with that of your loved one to symbolically make the flight. Yourself, you can do suborbital out of New Mexico, orbital, and they have a lunar flight coming up. In fact, I think they have two lunar flights coming up. The first one is supposedly late next year. So if you're interested in this, check them out, Celestis.com, and tell them you heard about them on the Space Show. It's a really great ceremony. You get a video of the flight. You get memorabilia from the flight. I mean, it is really something. National Space Society sponsors us. They typically do ISDC every year, but it didn't happen this year because of the virus. It is part of what's going to be ISDC 2021, which is scheduled for Los Angeles, and hopefully everyone will be able to safely come and visit Los Angeles next year. So we'll be hearing more about that as the year progresses. You can check them out at space.nss.org. They also do work with space settlements, and they have other symposiums. They have information on space solar power. It's an organization that you will want to be part of. It's also a nonprofit. And then the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us. This is the highly detailed development chart that shows the path to becoming a space-faring race. You can see how the different technologies and destinations interact and build upon one another. If you go to the virtualspaceplan.com website, you can open it up and really see the interaction of detail. You can buy your own copy of it. It comes in two different kinds and types and sizes. It's very inspiring. It's also an excellent space educational tool for your family members and friends. So to get more information there, go to the, T-H-E, spaceplan.com, all one word. So, listeners, we're starting our second segment today with Dr. Ken Davidian. The paper of his that we're discussing from June 12th is Space Tourism Industry Emergence, Description and Data. There is a link to it on the blog for this show that I posted earlier this morning. Ken, welcome back to part two. How are you?
Thank you very much. You're doing real well. And I want to take this opportunity to encourage listeners to go to the shop that you've got set up and buy some T-shirts. I just went and bought two.
Oh, terrific.
And, yeah, I think, that would be fun to see a lot more of those T-shirts around.
Absolutely. Listeners, toll-free number, if you want to call us, is 866-687-7223. And then, again, email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Todd in San Diego has an email question for you. And he said, through your research and the amount of time you've been involved in this, do you detect a growth in space tourism interest? Is it pretty constant, or has it in some way declined?
So that's a great question, Todd. And I think there's absolutely an interest. I mean, there's a couple different ways that we looked at that, or at least that I looked at that. Number one was looking at the number of times the phrase space and tourism, the word space and tourism, were used in a title or an abstract of different publications. So I looked at AIAA space conferences over the years. I looked at the International Astronautical Congress papers over the years. I also just looked at a straight-up Google Scholar search using those keywords combination. And you definitely see an increase in the number of citations. So this would be a bibliometric kind of analysis of trying to see if there's an increased level of activity, you know, based on those terms. So I would say just that's one way that we looked at it. Number two, you just look at the number of significant events that have happened in the industry. And again, we're looking primarily or uniquely at human suborbital. When you look at the number of events that happened, starting from the mid-1950s to about 1995, sort of was constant, almost to 2000 was kind of constant. Then it's just the number of events in terms of financing arrangements, people getting funding, or number of conferences held, or number of events that were held, like XPRIZE Cup, or the Rocket Racing League activities that were going on, all the different licenses that were issued in Facebook, or the different laws that were passed by countries, the amount of activity done by companies in their corporate political activities, whether it's the lobbyists or political action committees, all this sort of stuff. And then look at just the testing, the flight testing or ground testing done on vehicles. That number just totally picked up after 2001. So absolutely an increase of activity there. And then really what you're asking is, what about demand? Has that increased? And, of course, you know, there have been a number of public statements made by Virgin Galactic executives and representatives that talk about, we sold 100 tickets, we sold 200 tickets. So I plot that in my paper. I show the plot of the number of reported flight reservations for the Spaceship Two vehicle over time. And it, my chart ends at 2016, end of 2015. But you definitely see a growth there. Now, we don't know if that is the beginning of an exponential thing. It looks linear right there, but we don't know what the maximum Y value ultimately will be. So we absolutely, and this is not, again, as we talked about at the top of the show, this is not people that have flown, so we don't really know what the demand is. This is an indication for or a proxy for what the real demand might be. But this is, I think, our best indication of what demand is, the people that have put down reservations. And so it's not just the government buying rides, you know, and it's not just one independent source of demand. This is 600 or 100, at least, independent sources of demand, which is super important, I think, when you really want to claim that this is the commercial market. I mean, if the customer, if the only person that's developing a system is the customer, or if the only person buying a system is the government, then I would argue that that market might not be as commercial as one where there's more independent sources of demand.
I have another question along the same time, along the same lines, excuse me. Barbara says Upper New York, whatever that means. Maybe it's the West Side, I don't know. She says, does the fact that X-Corp sold tickets and then went under negatively impact the industry, or does it just shake it off?
Hi, Barbara. I'm not sure what I don't think it negatively impacted the industry. Yeah, they sold a bunch of tickets, a couple hundred, I think was the number they had reported. These are just losses, and I guess, to use your vernacular, they just shake it off, as long as that means the same thing to me as it does to you. That was a good showing, especially, again, X-Corp was a company that had tens of millions of dollars of investment. So they got pretty darn far down the road, and then for whatever reason, you know, I've had discussions with people, and I think in my dissertation I talk about how their main goal of human suborbital spaceflight sort of they had to bifurcate, and they had to go a different direction. You know, they ended up with some propulsion system contract with ULA and Air Force, and so then that kind of like pulled them off their Lynx work. And so then they laid off all the Lynx workforce, and they worked on the propulsion system work contracts for a while until they laid off everybody there and closed their doors. So I think it's just sort of like they just, you know, tried their hardest, but it didn't work. So I don't think that hurts demand. I think that's another good demonstration of a proxy for demand. But it just evaporated, I guess. Yeah.
I have another question. So this is Ted in Tucson, and he says, do you do any international methodology to see how space tourism fares in other countries? And do they contribute significantly to space tourism, or is it mostly an American deal?
So that's a great question. The way I selected what firms I would include in the study was not based on the country of origin, because I have all United States firms here. So you could say, oh, it's just U.S., why aren't we looking at international? The way I selected what firms would be included was I was saying they had to be building, had to be manufacturing, assembling, or testing flight hardware to be included in the study. So this is what disqualified Copenhagen suborbital, right?
Right.
Copenhagen suborbital, that they were never designed to be a business or to fly tourists. They're basically going to put a person in the vehicle and they're going to fly them. And it was never set up to be an operating business. And really nobody else kind of qualified that under that criteria. Now, this is when you're doing a PhD, this is good. You want to limit the field as much as possible. Now, granted, you want to include as many people as possible because that gives you more richer data. And you could say, but Ken, you know, you're talking about five companies total that you looked at, Scaled Composites, which joined forces with and turned into Virgin Galactic, kind of. You have the X-Corp, you had Rocket Plane, and you had Blue Origin. So those are the five, and only two are remaining. So you know, it'd be tempting to say, oh, and the sample size is two. It was five and it's two. And this is the difference between process research and variance research. If I was doing some sort of variance research where the independent variable was number of firms, then you're right. N would be 2. But in process research, it's the number of events that matters, not the number of companies. So, again, I've got about 400 events listed there, and I say about 400 because depending whether or not you count every single test flight of Spaceship Two as an event, I'm counting just the first and the end kind of thing. And so there's a lot of events in there that give depth and description and detail to the story, to the data I've collected. It's not variance research, so the number of firms don't really impact the validity and the accuracy of the data. But, like I said, I limited the scope so that international organizations, they're just not as far along. They're just not building or testing flight-scale hardware. Obviously, we could always expand the definition of who gets included and do more. The first thing they teach you when you go after a PhD is to get your PhD and get out, do your great research after you get your PhD. PhD is just to teach you how to do a research, not to do great research necessarily. So this is why publishing the data was so important, was I wanted to get it out there. So now it could be in the marketplace of ideas. And this is where you get to decide whether or not this is a bunch of hocus pocus or it's valid work.
Did you examine country of origin of the customers, the people buying the tickets, to give them a sort of a market impression of demand, or country of origin of the customers didn't enter into it either?
It did not enter into it. That's not a terrible idea. I think that's a really good idea. Again, I wasn't looking at the individual markets here. I'm looking at the industry evolution. I think at overall scale, probably at the community level, population level, community level. So it's probably not a terrible idea. I didn't go in that direction. But, future research could always do that kind of stuff. And we've got a good basis. And this is why the data is out there. As I say, I released it into the wild. It's out there so that people, if they want to go in a new direction, they've got something to start from. Because, my data shows that there were 85 reservations in 2004, 72 more reservations in 2006, and 43 in 2007. You can start looking at, like you said, where do those 87 people come from? Are those 85 people come from, and try to break them up by population? It wouldn't be impossible to do necessarily.
I have yet another email. So Randy's in the Phoenix area, and he says, not sure it's in your paper. I've downloaded it as we've been talking, but obviously I haven't had time to read it, but I did glance through it. Do you do any crystal ball gazing? Do you have any concerns about the fact that the market or the regulatory concerns for space tourism may change and either allow the industry to have even more growth or possibly shrink the industry if it's excessive?
So, at the beginning of the paper, you'll notice I've got 3 citations for 3 different jobs. And my primary job is working at the FAA, at the regulator, the Office of Commercial Space. I don't necessarily think that the regulations are in a state that will shrink the industry or impede it all that much. I know people might disagree with that, and people have different philosophies of whether or not regulations should grow with an industry to help it grow or should shrink to help it grow. But a lot of the data that's been done shows that as industries mature and become more complex, the institutions that impact that industry need to also mature and become more complex. So I don't think that the regulatory framework or the regulatory environment is going to impede growth. In fact, it's going to help it. And I would absolutely support the argument that it is the solidity of the framework that we have and the maturity of the framework that we have that gives investors confidence to invest in the industry, because they know that it's well-founded and it's served people in the past. It's served, over the last 20 years, suborbital operators. And there are changes being made, and we're always trying to improve at the FAA. But at the same time, I think that what we've got has been a solid foundation, and so it's actually stimulated investor participation in the industry. In terms of the crystal ball and what do I see for the future, I don't know. I wish I could tell the future, and I can't. And assuming that the future is a repeat of the past is something we don't want to assume when it comes to new industries. We want, and in fact, if I want to fly, I got to assume that the future is not a repeat of the past. So I, you know, drawing a linear interpretation from what I see is sort of a dangerous thing to do, I think.
You have another caller on hold. Hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Marshall in Little Old Renfro, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And you've been talking about the crystal ball and making projections, and it brought back the memories of working with the military where I was called upon to swag the variables. And to a certain degree, to even start a PhD thesis, you have to come in there and swag some of the values that you're going to start with and modify over the research. And more importantly, the swag where you come in there and guess what variables are dependent and independent.
You're absolutely right, Marshall, especially for variance research. For variance research, you have to do that. You have to guess what the IVs are and the DVs, the independent variables and the dependent variables. For process research, you don't. For process research, you're trying to see, you're trying to lay out a series of events and then trying to see patterns in the phenomenon that evolve. So you kind of, it's a different perspective, and it's, you know, this is a different perspective that I have been pushing for the last couple of years within, you know, the space, our little community, just because people have been so trained, especially in here, have been so trained to think in terms of IVs and DVs. We think that variance research is the only research that exists. And it is, frankly, the data collection is easier, and it's easier to go through all the stats and justify. And I think a lot of engineering PhDs where you're doing analyses and collecting data and stuff might be, is more along the line of variance research. When it comes to social science research, it starts with the process research function. And so those methods are a little bit different because you don't know what the IVs and DVs are. And the beauty of the process research is that you might find a whole set of IVs and DVs that you didn't know were there or were important. For example, mm-hmm. I'm going through a process now, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, I'm sort of got propositions in my head that, again, it's not the number of variations or number of sources or number of total demand that matters or the level of demand, but it's the number of independent sources of demand. Again, if you have one large customer, let's say you have the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Army and Navy and NASA and Energy all buying space flights or something, but they're all controlled by the U.S. government. They're all, you know, getting their budgets from Congress. They're not independent sources. So that's one big customer. And so maybe, you know, maybe the fact that you have to look at the independence of goal setting of the organization to be able to, you know, properly describe the industry. You know, this is where the theory development comes in, and that comes out of process research. So you're absolutely right for variance research, but for process research, different. That's what I would contend with.
Mm-hmm. I also want to ask David, at what price per pound to orbit did you think space tourism would take off?
I'd have to go back and see what I put in my paper because I really don't remember. But I was pretty much buying what the companies were promoting, hook, line, and sinker. So the going price, and this was interesting because when I was doing my paper, the tourism that was talked about was single stage to orbit. It was not suborbital. And the original rocket plane and X-Core and there were a couple of others were all promoting and touting single stage to orbit. And they talked about in the neighborhood of $250,000 to $350,000 a person. And only when those companies started going under, and this was after my dissertation had been published, did suborbital become what they talked about. So they didn't want to fade from the scene, so all of a sudden rocket plane was suborbital. All of a sudden X-Core had a suborbital version, and on and on and on. in the entire time of research that I did for my dissertation, I only came across one person who called my attention to the fact that single-stage to orbit was likely total BS and to watch out. So I have tried to find this guy, and I'm not going to – I don't remember his name, but I have it written down. He was an interview with Boeing that I did through my dissertation advisor who introduced me to him, and he took me through the engineering of what's involved in single-stage to orbit, including being able to land and all sorts of different things. And he said, this is the biggest bunch of crap that's being sold to people ever. And he documented it for me. So there was an entire section of my dissertation that I dedicated to what he was saying. But then the companies were all promoting single stage to orbit. And my Stanford advisor was having his class work on what he called was the Stanford single stage and a half to orbit. So they were talking about orbital tourism. Again, just in terms of timing for my project, suborbital really didn't get talked about until after my work had gone in to be published and you started seeing the single stage to orbit falling by the wayside. But I think they were still talking about $250,000 to $350,000. Maybe Ken remembers the history better than I do.
Well,
no, those numbers sound about right, because at $50 million, let's say, for an orbital flight, you know, and figure 200 kilograms, you know, with whatever, you know, per person, that comes out to about $250,000 a kilo.
You know, and you'd go to that conference that they had while XPRIZE was still going on down in Las Cruces. I know you were there, Ken.
Yep.
Frequently, and Rocket Plane had a Learjet as a model there,
right,
that they were
right.
going to convert to their orbital space plane.
Right.
And so they had a mock-up, or maybe it was a Learjet hull. I don't know if it was actually a Learjet or if it was just a model. And this wasn't for suborbital. This was their orbital plane. When they went under, my friend who's dead now, Rita Anderson, tried really hard to buy that model. And she wanted to put it on a stand in her Beverly Hills home's front yard, although she really thought it'd probably be torn down by the city. But they hauled that model off, believe it or not, to a junkyard in Oklahoma City. So what a loss. But
This is exactly the area that I find really interesting, is to come in there and attack a problem when you don't have any idea what the final solution is, and you're just kind of guessing at it. And one of the big positives that we have with Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos is they can look at the problem and say, I'll put $1 billion on that bet.
What I was going to say was, this is really interesting because, you know, I had when I came back to NASA in 2004, I started working in the Centennial Challenges program. Everything was about prizes. Louis Blériot, the guy that won the English Channel, single flight across the English Channel, he was kind of that guy. He knew what the goal was, fly across the channel. He went through 11 designs before he actually won. And he didn't do it mathematically the way the Wright brothers were doing it. You should look up, you know, Google Louis Blériot and look at some of his aircraft designs. He had crazy aircraft designs because it was more of an artistic endeavor for him. He really didn't know what the answer was going to look like, so it was really kind of interesting.
What's his first name?
Louis. Louis.
Oh, okay. Okay, Louis Blériot. Okay.
Blériot. Yeah.
Cool.
Anyway, that's enough for me today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Marshall, for your call. Listeners, I know we're coming up on the time, but if somebody else wants to get in on the act and talk with Ken, please dial quickly. 1-866-687-7223. The same for your emails. Is there... I know the paper has a conclusion, but is there sort of a summary or a conclusion that would be designed for space advocates, for the space enthusiasts?
Well, you know, sort of. Let me say sort of, and I don't think it's necessarily in the paper. Because in the paper, what it says is, again, there were two goals to the paper. One is to tell the story,
right?
And one is to put the data out there so it can be used by others. And what I would want to tell other folks is, you know, there's a real need in my humble opinion. There's a real need to do this kind of research for all the different commercial space transportation segments, small sat launchers, even human orbital, high altitude balloons, all of them. And like I said, spaceport. And we're doing a couple of them right now. But if nothing else, if we can get this level of detailed data for all the different industry segments and then let that out into the public domain, now you've got an encyclopedic knowledge of the history of these industries. And the beauty of where we're at in time is that these industries are just starting up, so we can get this detail. This is the kind of detail that's lost if you don't get it while it's happening. And because we tend to remember the winners and not the losers, right? Whereas this is detailing everything about, you know, all the details about everybody that comes in and goes out. And a lot of times, like if we try to do this kind of this research for like the Earth-to-orbit launch vehicles that were developed during the space race and stuff, it's a huge undertaking, and we probably won't be able to get it the same level of detail. So we're in this unique position of being able to get all this detail right now and then continually update it. So if folks have, any type of, and we're talking about enthusiasts now, you know, there needs to be some support for doing this kind of base-level research so we understand the story, and we need to tell the story so people, know what us old timers know, and I'll consider myself an old timer because I'm over 60 now. This is stuff that we lived through, in the 90s and early 2000s, and you've got a whole bunch of excited, enthusiastic young people coming into the industry now that kind of don't know this part of the story. So we need to tell that story and keep that that flame alive. And so I'm excited about doing this research. It's not for everyone, but like I said, I'm working with students right now here in the U.S., and I'm actually working with students at Cape Town still. They're doing process research because, when I talked about pooling data and using other industry data to support, multiple research projects, it doesn't have to come from the space industry. So there are two students I'm working with in Cape Town, one working in the mining industry and the other one in the healthcare industry, using the same data collection process, and that data should all be applicable. So we want to share data as much as possible, and that's a very Ubuntu kind of, to use an African kind of philosophy, it's a very, Ubuntu kind of perspective of the data collection.
Does South Africa, does Cape Town have a space component to it? Does it have a lot of space interest in it?
They do. A lot is relative, but they do have quite a bit. They're heavily involved in small sats and the and a lot of the subsystems, like optical systems, sensor systems that go into small sats. There is a South African Space Agency, SANSA, and they do what they can, and they're very active in the international community. It turns out that the gentleman who, and I forget his name right now, but the gentleman who is the head of SANSA, is actually now also going to the University of Cape Town, Graduate School of Business, to get his PhD from that business school. So I kind of preceded him by a couple of years. By the way, UCT, University of Cape Town, is typically one of the top three universities on the continent of Africa, not just within South Africa. And the Graduate School of Business is triple crown rated. I mean, it's got three accreditations from international organizations, and it gets consistently rated within the top 100 internationally. So it's a good school. I mean, I've had a lot of people poo-poo, getting a PhD from overseas, and you get out of it what you put into it. Cape Town is a great school. Cape Town is a fantastic city. They're going through hard times now like everybody else, and I wish all my friends there a lot of good luck and hang in there. Thank God for Zoom. I get to see him from time to time. So I was really happy at Cape Town. Really, really great university.
Looks like I've got one possibly final email question for you. And Linda is in Denver, Colorado. And Linda says there is a lot of talk, and I've even heard papers presented, on spacecraft launching from the moon because of the low gravity well to go to Mars, or spacecraft coming up for refueling at an orbital depot and then going to another destination or Mars.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
in terms of the space transportation models that you're talking about, is there room for a space transportation vehicle being made and launched from another location other than Earth, be it free space in an orbiting station or possibly off of the lunar surface with a lower gravity well? It would seem to me that might change quite a bit of the variables.
Maybe in terms of industry emergence, I don't think it'll change it very much. You know, personally, again, I feel that space is not unique. There have been plenty of industries that have started up that are high-tech, require a lot of money, and their customers are in physical danger of using the product. You think of fast cars, think of aviation. You know, there's a lot of them, even steamboats. I mean, when the boilers were blowing up, you know,
right.
not necessarily safe. So I don't think the org theory models will be much different. The only caveat I would put on the statement is that, you know, again, think this is not years away, it's decades away. And so this is one of the reasons I picked suborbital, is that, you know, it's absolutely near term. We're seeing the emergence right now. There are a lot of notional papers and concept papers about the transportation modes that you talked about, and then you asked about, Linda, but it's decades away. Elon Musk is the closest thing we have to on-orbit fueling and, you know, going to the moon and or onto Mars. And still, that's probably a decade away, too. And so we'll see. I mean, I'm super impressed with what he's doing with Starship, and I can hardly wait to see the 150-meter hop and then ultimately the 20-kilometer hop. You know, but things take time, and so, you know, I just hope I'm alive to see it.
Got to keep living long. That's the thing. Have we omitted something you wanted to talk about or describe in your paper, or that we should know about? Have we forgotten to cover something, or do you want to add something?
Let me just mention New Space, the journal. So,
that
David provided on his page. It will take you to the table of contents of issue or volume 8, issue 2. It came out in June. Got a nice picture of a space. A guy in a spacesuit on the moon there. We deal with innovation and entrepreneurship in space. We have many different types of articles in our in the journal. They range from general types of questions like what should the air quality standards be, you know, for, you know, space flight, you know, again, how to build these industry infrastructure elements that my paper talked about. You know, things like that are absolutely talked about within our journal. Also, we have like new general descriptions of new space or non-governmental space activities, as well as very specific new space plans. Those are also included in the journal. There'll be general discussions, and my editorials and papers sometimes deal with just things like, what does commercial mean? So these are kind of general studies that evaluate existing terminologies or laws or regulations that can deal with a non-governmental or commercial space. And then also we'll have just plain old market analyses. So a bunch of different types of papers covering all of the different disciplines. We're the only kind of journal out there that's looking at specifically at non-governmental space, focused on entrepreneurship and innovation in the space sector. So I would encourage you to Google it and check it out.
Can people submit articles, or do you take articles from people, or do you invite people?
Absolutely. There's a I'm sure there's a link on there for how to submit. Absolutely. We would encourage folks to submit. Take a look at a couple of the articles that are on the website that are open access, like my paper and other papers like that. You can see what kind of style we go for. It's a journal, so it's going to be a little bit more formal. If you give us a paper that is basically a PowerPoint presentation with some bullets and stuff, we're going to say, you know, please make it more narrative. Please be more descriptive. Please get rid of the, you know, cartoony graphics. It's going to go through peer review with two reviewers. You're going to get comments back and have to revise it and then resubmit if there are some comments. So, yeah, it's a journal, and I don't think we can rank it, because I don't think we reach the 20 peer review papers a year limit yet, but we're getting there. And we're in volume number 8, year 8 right now. The original editor-in-chief was Scott Hubbard, former Mars czar and former director of NASA Ames Research Center. He retired a couple years ago, and I took over mid volume 7. So I'm entering my second year as editor in chief. I was the associate editor under Scott.
Who does the peer review?
So I've got a bunch of different reviewers. If you look at the front matter of the journal, you'll see the editorial board, a lot of big names there. We've also created a new associate editor board. I've got a great associate editor board that's super, super diverse geographically, gender-wise, you know, demographic-wise, everything. And so in terms of different industry sectors and different experience bases and stuff, they've been doing a lot of my reviews. We've got currently we've got a special issue coming out about governance of new space in Africa on the continent. And so that's going to be coming out probably 9.1 or 9.2, I'm guessing. So that'll be early next year. And we're hoping to have another special issue on Indian space activities coming up. And so, yeah, we've got a lot going on. We do interviews with different folks. And in fact, I've got an interview coming up with one of our associate editor board members, Dr. Paola Bellingari. She's in Italy, and so we interview her, and we also interview the group of NASA folks that are putting together the NASA Commercial Space Symposium that will be held next March 2021, maybe virtually, maybe in person. We'll find out. So that interview is coming up in the next issue as well. So keep your eyes out for 8.3. That's coming up in September.
Do you have another paper that you're working on?
I'm currently working on a paper that gets back in 2016 I wrote a paper called Do Commercial Companies Exist? And the outcome of that paper was kind of, well, commercial companies, when you're analyzing it, talking about the company probably doesn't make as much sense as talking about the activity, because the same company might do commercial activities and non-commercial activities, right? Governmental activities.
Uh-huh.
So drawing a clean line of analysis around it probably doesn't make sense to draw it around the company, but around the activity. And so this has been a theme of what is new space, what is commercial, that has been repeated many, many times. We've printed many of the articles. The articles have been presented at the International Astronautical Congress, so it's a worldwide discussion. So I'm working on a paper right now that sort of aggregates all that, but now it puts it into an org theory kind of perspective of evolution model of organizational change, of market change, looking at the forces of variation, selection, and retention, which are the three forces of evolution, trying to, again, create propositions that identify what are the relevant IVs and DVs that would help you identify whether a market is commercial or not. And so, you know, using that lens. So that's the paper I'm working on right now.
Well, we look forward to seeing it and to talking to you about it on the space show. So please keep us in mind.
Absolutely, David. You know I will.
All right. Well,
thank you very much.
Ken, stay safe and healthy and well with you and your family and everyone back there. And I look forward to our next discussion. And listeners, that will be it for today. So we say goodbye from Ken, David, and the space show. And everybody enjoy what's left of the weekend. Again, our hearty congratulations to both NASA and SpaceX for just an amazing return to commercial human spaceflight. We love it. And everybody stay safe. And as always, what we say on the space show, keep looking up. Goodbye, everybody.